Good afternoon, everyone.
Hi, Dan Bond.
The time is 1:36 p.m., Thursday, January 25th. We're in the State Capitol Room, the Gruenberg Room, number 120. Present, we have Representative Sadler, Representative Parrish, Representative Sponholz, Representative Reinbold, myself, Representative Tuck. Let the record reflect that we do.
Thank you very much. That we do have a quorum to conduct business. A couple of housekeeping rules. First of all, let's please silence your electronic devices. And before I begin, I would like to thank Brian Glynn with House Records for helping us out today. Same with Kelsey Goodell in the back, who's moderating the meeting, and our committee aide, Kendra Kloster. Also joining us is Representative Rauscher. Today we have two items on the agenda. We have H.E.R. 17, the Hmong Memorial Burial Rights by Representative Rep Tarr, and then House Bill 307, the Military Justice and Militia Civil Relief by yours truly. And so let's first take up H.J.R. 17. Representative Tarr, if you want to come forward with your staff. And we do have public testimony still open. And we have one amendment before us. Should be on everyone's table. It's been passed out to everybody. So is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify on this resolution? Okay, seeing none, is there anybody online that would like to testify? I don't show anybody online. So at this moment, we will close public testimony. And available for questions and testimony, we also have Verdi Bowen with the Veterans Affairs Administrator, Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. I was expecting him to be online, but I don't see him online at the moment. And we have Bob Dole, our Deputy Commissioner for Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, in the audience with us. So, any questions for the bill sponsor, Representative Reinbold?
And Mr. Chairman, we didn't hear very clear testimony, and I know that they had some very impassioned testimony. Did you send that already to our emails? I'm sorry if I'm a tad behind.
Yes, they have been sent to.
Okay, excellent. That's what I need to know. Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair to the sponsor, what's the decision point? I want to make sure I'm not overloading the system here. So what is the decision point? This is a resolution asking Congress to authorize full military burials for Hmong veterans of the Vietnam War. Is there a point at which the federal government is scheduled or anticipates making a decision about this issue, or is this a continuing, ongoing issue?
Through the chair to Representative Sadler, and actually this speaks to the amendment that we consider a friendly amendment by Representative Rauscher. Currently, Senator Lisa Murkowski, and I believe this has been supported by Senator Sullivan, has the Hmong Veterans Service Recognition Act. It was introduced in May of last year. It's S1179. And what I would hope is that if we could get this through the legislature, then it would be sent along with her, and it would give her additional sort of support for her effort at the national level to show that her state legislature is behind her in that effort to get that bill passed. And I know this isn't the first time that she's introduced this bill, but in this Congress, this is the current version of that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And let me also point out that we have Brian Duffy, who is the Administrative Services Director for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, in the audience as well. Any other comments? Questions? Do we have an amendment? Any amendments?
Mr. Chairman, at this moment, I'd like to move amendment number one.
I'll object just to allow the maker of the motion to speak to the motion.
Thank you very much. We want to speak to your amendment?
Yes. It's simple. It just it adds the fact that Senator Murkowski has introduced this bill. It's self-explanatory. I just thought that it might fit well with what we're trying to do there, and since it was our senator that moved it.
Any further comments?
Mr. Chairman, I withdraw my objection.
The objection has been removed. Any other further objections?
One other thing to add, with permission, through the chair, that bill that she introduced is still in play in Congress right now.
Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate it, Representative Rauscher. All right, hearing no further objections, amendment number one has been adopted. Any other further discussions under H.J.R. 17? feel free to speak out.
Sure.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move passage of House Bill 307 from the committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal notes.
As amended?
As amended. That's correct. Thank you.
Take a brief at ease. Okay, back on the record, Representative Sadler.
Mr. Chairman, I would withdraw my previous motion, and I would offer this motion. I move that the House Military and Veterans Affairs Committee pass from committee House Joint Resolution Number 17, version 30-LS0723/Delta, as amended with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
We have a motion before us. Any objection? Seeing no objection, congratulations. House Joint Resolution 17 passes the Military and Veterans Affairs Committee, and we'll take a brief at ease real quick to sign that. Calling the Military and Veterans Affairs Committee back to order. Now before us, we have House Bill 307, which is the Military Justice and Militia Civil Relief Act. I would like to invite the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs folks to the table. We have before us Deputy Commissioner Bob Dole, who's here in person. We have in the audience Administrative Service Director for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, Brian Duffy. Online, we have Staff Judge Advocate Lieutenant Colonel Chris Weaver. Also, we have the Deputy Staff Judge Advocate Blake Circle online for us today. So House Bill 307 is a continued effort to modernize and update our Alaska Military Code. It provides statutory changes to incorporate recent updates from the Federal Uniform Code of Military Justice, the UCMJ, and the Service Members Civil Relief Act, the SCRA. So in 2016, the Alaska's Military Command worked with the legislature to pass the Alaska Code of Military Justice to provide greater ability to pursue and prosecute those service members who violate military rules and protocols. This bill, House Bill 307, is a continuation of those efforts. And basically what it would do, it would update the crimes recognition by the UCMJ. It would establish a procedure within the Code of Military Justice for a service member who commits a sexual offense to register as a sex offender or a child kidnapper. It'll update offenses that are subject to court-martial proceedings. It'll update consumer protections for service members. So in close, this is just one of those additional bills that we're going to be running through the through this Special Committee on Military and Veterans Affairs to guarantee the safety of Alaskans and the security of our law enforcement procedures. And so at this point, I would like to hand it over to Lieutenant Colonel Weaver and Deputy Commissioner Bob Dole to go through the sectional. And Representative Savage, do you have a question?
No, I'll hold my questions, but there are another sections of the bill.
Okay.
And whoever wants to take it away from here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Deputy Commissioner Dole, I'll offer some brief opening comments, and then Lieutenant Colonel Weaver and Captain Circle will do the deep dive in the 39 sections of this bill. The department welcomes and supports this bill. It builds on the bipartisan efforts led by Vice Chair Representative Ledoux a couple of years ago in HB 26, which gave us a viable Alaska Code of Military Justice. This I consider ongoing maintenance and tweaks to that rather than a huge overhaul. It's incremental improvements to make it more effective. Lieutenant Colonel Weaver will go through the key parts there. It keeps us in sync with the good ideas that have come out in on the federal side. We believe the provisions that prohibit sexual relationships between military personnel of in the same chain of command avoid and situations of special trust is consistent with civilian criminal law for similar situations, such as prisoner and corrections officer, teacher and student, where consent is problematic. We welcome the opportunity for service member convicted of a sexual assault under the ACMJ to also have to register at the sex offender registry. That we think fills an important gap in terms of avoiding a predator situation. We also believe that the provision preventing military personnel from rejecting non-judicial punishment akin to a parking ticket in favor of pursuing a court-martial to settle minor disciplinary matters is a necessary step forward. At this time, I'd like to ask the chair to recognize Lieutenant Colonel Weaver to proceed with the section-by-section analysis.
And Lieutenant Colonel, are you available?
I'm here, Mr. Chair.
Okay, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Lieutenant Colonel Chris Weaver, the staff judge advocate for the Alaska National Guard. Through the chair, thank you, committee members, for hearing this bill. Basically, this bill does various things throughout, broadly speaking, as Mr. Dole has pointed out. It allows for sexual offender registration for service members convicted under the Alaska Code of Military Justice. Well, what it still does is it ties the broad definition of sexual assault and sexual contact under the Alaska Code of Military Justice with the civilian crime so that a service member convicted under the Alaska Code of Military Justice would have to register just like a civilian convicted under a civilian like crime in Alaska would have to do. It also allows provisions for the service member civil relief act to apply service member to deploy within the state for civil emergencies. It gives more specificity to the current provision on what exactly a right a service member has while deployed. Typically, these are civilian-like liabilities to the military member who may have a phone contract or an internet cable or rent issue, and because they're deployed, they can't take care of it because they're deployed locally within the state, taking care of the state, and they're an emergency. They're not able to take care of that civilian obligation. This bill also takes out what's called a no turn down provision of the non-judicial punishment currently in the ACMJ. This means that a service member accused of offenses that don't rise to a court martial level, cannot choose an expensive court martial instead of receiving the non-judicial punishment. I remind the committee members in their discussions when the original ACMJ came through the committee that minor offenses is like a non-judicial punishment is something that is an accusation that the commander hears, and minor punishments are given if the service member is found guilty. It is literally non-judicial punishment. No judge, but a commander using the commander's inherent authority to discipline and make sure that the force is ready to do its military operations. This bill also updates current AG&J with substantive offenses recently adopted by Congress for the federal UCMJ. Many of the offenses listed reflect reoccurring issues within the military worldwide. So, for example, retaliation is a major concern with the military worldwide, and the Congress has made part of the UCMJ retaliation as an offense. And basically, the retaliation provision is in Section 18 of this bill, page 11. It basically mirrors, it comes very close to mirroring what's called the Military Whistleblower Protection Act. That's a federal law. And in this case, it makes it an offense in Alaska. It also has a provision that outlaws, makes an offense, sexual activities with a trainee by a person of special trust. So a recruiter, for example, has a special trust with the recruitee, and non-consensual sexual activities would be prohibited in the ACMJ should you adopt this bill. Another provision, as an example, is recording a person's private areas without consent. So this came out through various newspaper articles. It was brought up in newspaper articles where certain military members were filming other military members in positions in the shower or when they're exposed. This would prohibit that kind of conduct as well. These are the major provisions of this bill. We'd be happy to go into more specificity. I have with us Captain Blake Circle, who is well more versed on the sexual offender registration, answering any of those questions as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a brief question. For the past several meetings, I've heard a big booming noise from that side of the room. What is that noise? I don't know if it's like a book dropping on the table. Is it a microphone thing? Is it a?
It might be getting bumped. The microphone.
Yeah, that's the one.
It's a microphone.
Okay, good. They're all doing. Okay.
Yours does it to us too.
Mine doesn't.
You did it.
I did it. Okay. If I did, I apologize. But I'm just wondering what that noise was. And that was the only question there.
Okay.
Until we get to the third question.
Representative Reinbold.
Thank you. Who would be the person most appropriate to address Section 21 and 22?
Chris.
Lieutenant Colonel Weaver, would you like to take a stab at that? Just to explain a little bit more about Sections 21 and 22. And this has to do with drunk on duty and drunkenness and other incapacitation.
Mr. Chair, I'll give it a try. Is there a question that I missed?
Basically, we're just asking you to just go in a little bit more detail on 21 and 22. I think this is really important. This was an area I was hoping was in the bill, and it is in the bill. But if you could just basically highlight Section 21 and 22. And then I have a specific question. It says while status as a prisoner is drunk, and I'm wondering if that drunk reflects in Section 21, because it up there it says having to do with indulgence in alcoholic beverage or any drug, making the militia members commit offenses. So I want to know if Section 22 also not only is alcohol, but it has to do with drugs as well.
Ma'am, through the chair, Lieutenant Colonel Chris Weaver, Alaska National Guard. So drunkenness on duty, drunkenness and incapacitating offenses, this actually comes through what's called, comes into the Alaska Code of Military Justice and to the substantive articles of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Via what's called the general article, meaning there are articles in the UCMJ that require an additional element that it either has to be detrimental to good order and discipline or it reflects badly on the service. So the there's this additional element. It's any action that does those things. What the Congress has done is they moved it into a substantive crime, into a specific crime, into the UCMJ, and that's the proposal here, into the ACMJ, to make any kind of member or a sentinel or anybody who has a physician who would be drunk on duty or unable to perform the duty. So what it's important to remember in the military, like a lot of professions, where you have big equipment or weapons, that any kind of incapacitation prohibited. So it doesn't even have to be an illegal drug. It could be any drug. If I'm pulling guard duty, it would be my obligation to refrain from taking that alcohol or a drug, whether it's over the counter or what have you, and not perform those duties. That's what these two sections do. I hope I answered your question.
Can I?
Yes, follow up, Representative Rembold.
Okay, not exactly. I mean, I understand, you know, overall what the subsection or what section 21 and 22 are doing. What my question is that in Section 22, it just talks about drunk. It doesn't talk about use of drugs. However, in Section 21, it talks about drugs or other incapacitating offenses. Where I'm going with all this is, does this include drug use of drugs and even the use of something like the date rape drug? That's where I'm going with this.
It includes all drugs, whether over the counter or not. It, as far as the date rape drug goes, I would have to say that if it's self-induced, then it would. In other words, the date rape drug for a passing it, somebody taking it themselves and then performing the duty. If it means passing that drug on to somebody else, then this is something else. This is so you don't report to duty in an incapacitated manner.
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
Deputy Commissioner Dole, through the Chair, Representative Rembold. The intent was to include any sort of chemically induced incapacitation in Section 22 as well. Looking at the language, I recognize there is a difference there that it may be an appropriate place to look at an adjustment or an amendment, but the department's desire is that if a prisoner is taking whatever to get in an altered state, that would be actionable.
And through the chair?
Yeah, Representative Russell.
Thank you. I'm just so thankful this is in the bill. I mean, this is something that I'd actually talked to the chairman about, and I'm really happy that it's here. I just believe that it needs to have better clarifying language, and I'll be happy to help draft amendment with working with the chairman on that.
Okay, thank you, Representative Rembold. Representative Sponholz.
Thank you, Lieutenant Colonel Weaver. Since Representative Rembold has called our attention to sections 21 and 22, I'm going to stick with this for a second. I have two clarifying questions. I'll start with section 21. There is an exclusion of a sentinel or an outlook or a lookout, and I'm a little curious about why we would exclude a sentinel or a lookout, since it seems like dereliction of duty by being intoxicated in those situations would be bad as well. Was that an oversight, or?
Yeah, through the chairman, Lieutenant Colonel Chris Weaver, Alaska National Guard. So I believe that's addressed in Section 23. So two different crimes, two different offenses, pardon me. So it's addressed. I guess the easy answer is to say, The UCMJ is also broken out into two separate crimes.
Okay, I see what you're saying. It's in Section 23, it looks like, further down. The sentinel or lookouts are addressed there?
Through the chair, yes, ma'am.
Okay, so, Mr. Sheriff, yeah, if I could, one more follow-up. Never mind. I'm done. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There do seem to be several questions arising as to why Section 21 calls out specifically alcoholic beverage or drugs, and other sections do not. I could certainly see where those same provisions and language could be applied to Section 23 or to Section 22. So I guess I have many questions, but I guess I'll ask that one, ask for the chance to follow up. Why in Section 21 does it reference both alcohol and drug, and Section 22 and 23 do not?
Through the chair, and for Chris Weaver, Alaska National Guard. I'm sorry, Mr. Gold, were you going to say something? I heard feedback. Sorry, Lieutenant Colonel Chris Weaver, Alaska National Guard. I think it's worthy for us to take a look at it. It could be a scrivener's error, and we'll take a look at it.
Good deal.
Yes, Representative Sadler, follow up.
Thank you. Follow up. And frankly, in Section 23, it specifies lookout or sentinel who wrongfully sits down. My understanding is a soldier's general orders include walking a post in a military manner, which I assume means standing and awake. Does that not kind of incorporate it by inclusion?
And the key to that is wrongfully, so there's some sort of, exactly as you say, sir, Representative Sadler, if I'm ordered to keep walking around, but I'm not.
Fair enough. Okay, thanks. And a general follow-up question. It seems in general, Colonel Weaver, that sections 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, and 22 pretty much look like these are the kinds of things that I would think that I assume that the federal UCMJ covers and are incorporated into Alaska's Code of Military Justice wholesale. Isn't there some provision in Alaska's state military code that would simply address and adopt these significant changes and additions just by reference?
Through the chair, Lieutenant Colonel Chris Weaver, Alaska National Guard. That is one method of doing it. Other states have taken that method. The Alaska method has been to specify each offense and update the code as the code is updating.
If I may add that part of these updates is making sure that any serviceman or person would be able to look up and know clearly what's expected of them and what the consequences would be.
So while there might be, so while there might be some redundancy for clarity of reference and application, the redundancy is acceptable.
Yeah, and I think also some of it may be moved even.
Okay.
Just so everything follows logical order.
And I do have questions about the Service Members Civil Protection Act and the inclusion of that, but we'll get to that after we're done with this, I suspect. So
thank you very much. Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and through the chair. If the Alaska Code of Military Justice is out of step with the Uniform Code of Military Justice, what are the potential legal consequences to that?
This is Lieutenant Colonel Chris Weaver, Alaska National Guard, through the chair. I don't know about, I'm going to say legal consequences. The UCMJ and the ACMJ really are about providing a disciplined military force for the purposes of the National Guard, both for the war fight, when it's called active duty, Title 10 in foreign lands, and also for the domestic response here in Alaska. I think I would phrase it more in not legal consequences, but to ensure that our military force mirrors the federal military force so that we're able to, A, have a disciplined force here in Alaska in a very emergency situation, but also applying the same or very similar standards that would be applied to us overseas.
Follow up, Representative Parrish.
Thank you. And through the chair, again, thank you. I think that's a commendable goal, and any time we can feed off of someone else's notes, I'm generally in favor.
Thank you very much. Representative Sadler on service members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If it's time to go to, I will go to Section 7, which I believe begins on page 6. So I'm going to try and get in the record. I did a little bit of brief research into what the Service Members Civil Relief Act is and what it applies to. And in general, it says that a military member who receives orders is exempt from many of the consequences of kiting on bills or repairs or rent or this, that, and the other, and provides a remedy that a court order could provide some get back for the vendors. But I guess my question is, can we get a briefing generally on what the Service Vendors Civil Relief Act is, its provenance and provisions?
Deputy Commissioner, would you like to take a stab at that?
For the record, Deputy Commissioner Dole, Mr. Chair, through the Chair, Representative Sadler, generally speaking, the Service Members Civil Relief Act is a federal body of law which arose to protect service members from being penalized for things beyond their control as incident to military duty on the civilian side. That is, when the military has ordered them to relocate to another place, that the individual is not liable for the duration of the payments on a lease for a period after they've been ordered to relocate. By analogy, the other services you see in this bill, such as athletic clubs, internet services, or other personal services like that, it's a means of protecting basically service members from being the one liable for the government ordering them to do something.
Follow-up, Representative Sadler.
Yeah. And just speaking conversationally, is this a relatively new act, or is this, what does this date to?
Through the Chair, Representative Sadler, the original SCRA goes back decades. It's been recodified recently on the federal side and brought up to date to address more specific things like internet services that didn't exist as it's something you'd buy decades and decades ago. Okay. And I believe this law assures that for individuals called to state active duty, they get the same protections as federally. Mm-hmm. For that, but the civil SCRA is decades old.
Okay, and I would actually, and before we have the chance to vote on this important section, I do hope to get some more detailed information about just all the provisions of the SCRA. And in my understanding, well, is this for a long-term piece, a permanent change of station, or is it for a short-term deployment, for a training deployment, TDY? What's the SCRA designed to cover in terms of duration?
Through the Chair, Representative Sadler, is designed to cover a time span where it is no longer feasible to retain a service. So a weekend of training, probably not for a lease, but a 90-day deployment might very well be, depending. But it's designed basically to provide that relief, certainly for a permanent change of station, but also for individuals such as when they've done the one-year deployments. Mm-hmm. Recently, they could use these provisions to end contracts that was no longer viable for them to keep.
With the Chair's indulgence, can I pursue some more questions?
Yeah, and just to make sure I'm understanding your questions, Representative Sadler, you want to know more about the Service Members Civil Relief Act?
Yes, because while they might provide benefits to the service members, and I'll be very interested to see what those are, it might place service providers, vendors, retailers, businesses in our home districts. It might be detrimental to their interests, so I'd just like to be able to balance the interests to see what they are. So I just need to know more.
Okay, well, if you can keep your questions to the ones that are in the bill right now. I mean, I don't want to go into all the federal codes right now, but Representative Sadler.
Thank you. I'm hoping I do see USC 3901 to 4043. That's a lot of federal code to look at, so I just need to understand more. I guess my other question would be, why would this be necessary to apply to the organized militia? I understand that the National Guard and Naval Militia is considered organized militia, but the definition of organized militia also, I believe, will include Alaska State Defense Force. Why is it necessary or advisable to include that in this Section 6?
Through the Chair, Representative Sadler, as you noted, there are federal provisions out there for when the Alaska Naval Militia or the two Alaska National Guard components are in a federal status. Mm-hmm. This provision deals with when placed into a state active duty for an extended period, such as that disaster recovery operation that's going to last 6 months, 9 months, a year long, where they are called to state active duty and ordered to do duty away from their primary home of residence where they would have these services lined up. So to the extent the Alaska Organized Militia is put into state active service, these provisions would apply.
And follow-up?
Representative Sather.
Has the Alaska State Defense Force ever been put into active duty by the state for more than 90 days in the past?
Through the Chair, Representative Sadler, not at this time, no.
Do you, following up, Do you anticipate situations in which ASDF could be potentially called upon to be on active duty for more than 90 days?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, in the event of a mass disaster such as a tsunami involving extensive community recovery, I could envision members of the Alaska Organized Militia being placed into state active duty for an extended period for 90 days or 180 days based upon the Katrina recovery, where 90 and 179-day tours were common.
But not for the ASDF. We didn't send people from Alaska down to Katrina.
Through the chair, Rep. Sadler, we did not. However, as a state, if we had a drilling member in Queefluk who was going to assist with a recovery in Petersburg, and that these are just two random places for this discussion, we would face the same issues there where we could PCS them in state for that, as happened within state active duty in the hurricane states for recovery.
And with your indulgence, last question. I do know the military appropriately goes to a great extent and great pains to make the transition required of military service easy. Is there any compensation or pay to military personnel for relocating for more than 90 days? Is there any moving pay or allowances that might be redundant to what the SCRE provides?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, the department will provide pamphlets with the whole specter of SCRA benefits that are available. Those are existing, and some exemplar packets from the active services in terms of permanent change of station information. The short answer, though, is no. For a relocation, the military will pay for the cost of moving your household goods from point A to point B. It will pay your travel cost for moving you and your family. It will pay for other incidental costs like that, such as if when relocating, there's a certain period you may be in transient or temporary housing, an on-base hotel, before your actual dwelling is available. But there is no funding available for contract severance penalties.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Sponholz.
Thank you. Through the chair, Deputy Commissioner Dole, so just to sort of clarify and make sure I understand this properly, essentially what we're doing is we're saying if the department deems it necessary to move somebody from one place or another for a official duty of at least 90 days, this would allow them to, say, not have to continue to pay their cable bill while they were in Petersburg, for example, if they were moving from Queefleck to Petersburg and they were going to be working 12-hour days and they may not have time to watch cable and their cable only works in Queefleck. They wouldn't have to pay that while they were in Petersburg, essentially. This would remove the obligation to adhere to that contract.
Through the chair, Representative Sponholz, that's correct. I'd like to check with the current federal regulations on that 90-day. That's my understanding, but yes, that's correct. Basically, for an extended period where they're not available, it would end the contract at that point.
Okay. Yeah, it says – just follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
It says right here in lines 19 and 20 on page 6, if a member receives official orders to relocate for a period of military service of at least 90 days to a location that does not support the contract – and the member provides written notice to the service provider as required under these, and then it lists the services. It sounds like this is just making it easier for our service providers to not have to go into debt while they're, providing a service to the state of Alaska and such. Am I correctly surmising this?
For the chair, Representative Sponholz, that's correct. That was the section I wanted to double check as we were sitting here. Yes.
Thank you. I thought I'd just cut to the chase then. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, Representative Sponholz. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. I appreciate this as the opportunity to probe this. If a person who serves with the State Defense Force were to be selected for training and were sent to a lower 48 facility, would they be on active duty, active state service for that period, and would they be eligible for protections under the SCRA and other provisions of this bill?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, conceivably, we could put a Alaska State Defense Force member in state active duty for out-of-state training in excess of 90 days. I honestly can't fathom that ever happening. As a matter of course, we do not place ASDF members in state active duty for training. Some have volunteered on their own time, but we don't pay.
Okay, fair enough. And one last question, through the chair. In general, I do understand that the SCRA is designed to make to relieve the service member of the burdens, but speaking informally, if someone's got a year-long contract with the Alaska Club or with a cable TV organization, in this case, if this provision is exercised, does the service provider, you know, GCI, Alaska Club, they just kind of eat that? They just have to accept that's the way it is?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, that's correct.
Or a better way to put that would be that could be their contribution to national defense, which is probably a better way to put it.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, that's correct.
Thank you, sir.
And if I may add that although they may have a contract, they're not obligated to provide any more service as well. So it's not like they're out of money, just out of the contract. Any other further questions on the Service Members Civil Relief Act or any other part of House Bill 307? Okay, at this time I'm going to go ahead and set House Bill 307 aside. So our next committee meeting will be on Thursday, February 1st, where we'll have an overview and status update from numerous state departments, the Department of Defense, and Solutions of Information Design about occupational licensing for military education, training and service credit for military service members, and temporary licenses for military spouses. And at this time, I'm going to go ahead and adjourn our Special Committee on Military and Veterans Affairs at 2:20. We're adjourned.